It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's government placed limits on gatherings this week to slow the spread of the coronavirus. We'll talk to a state lawmaker who says places of worship should be able to get some exemptions from that limit. First, sometimes we want dinner and we want it fast. That's understandable. We live busy lives, usually. But for some of us who have been experiencing a lot of changes in our schedules lately, we may want a cooking project that actually takes up more of our time. And some things are worth the wait, the extra planning, or maybe just a little more care. We want to hear from you on this week's edition of Food Friday. Have you found yourself in the kitchen maybe baking something this week? Are you looking for some cooking projects to take on? What are some of your favorite recipes to make when you have the time to do it? Maybe some recipes that are a little more finicky that require planning ahead. Give us a call with your complex cooking ideas. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Deb Perlman is with us. Deb created the Smitten Kitchen blog in 2006. Her most recent cookbook is called Smitten Kitchen Every Day, triumphant and unfussy new favorites. She's joining us now to share some of her favorite recipes for when you have a little more time to spare. Deb, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, before we get into the cooking, I mean, these are tough times for a lot of people, uncertain times. Do you find that, you know, cooking is a nice distraction, a nice bit of relief?
I'm definitely seeing it. I was really surprised at the spike in cooking. I guess it depends on your situation. I feel like some people have a lot of extra time. Some people are parents and they're trying to figure out how to do their jobs at home while homeschooling.
True.
But overall, there's been such a big spike in cooking at home. And it started out being a lot of interest in, like, what do I do with these rice and beans, or like, how do I use canned beans to make a whole meal, or what are some new things I can do with dried pasta? But it shifted after a few days, and I was surprised by the number of people who have asked me if I have suggestions of more elaborate cooking projects, since they have all the time in the world to get to them.
Now, I know we talked to you about your latest cookbook, which gives us some unfussy recipes. Do you like, though, when you have the time on your hands to do things that are a little more fussy, that take a little more planning ahead?
Yes. I think, like a lot of people, my cooking is really like one end of the pendulum or the other. Like, I either have a lot of time and I'm like, let's go make lasagna. Or I'm like, okay, I have like 20 minutes to get these kids dinner or they're going to lose it. So it's really just one or the other. There's only like two speeds, basically. But yeah, it's super nice if you can like take your time and do a long rice pizza dough. Or, you know, I know a lot of like kids and adults and, you know, lots of people are having birthday parties canceled and stuff. And like, what if you could make them a really nice cake at home to make it feel more special?
Now, time-consuming doesn't have to mean difficult, but that said, are you hearing from your fans, people who are thinking, okay, I want to learn whatever, a new technique, a new type of cooking, and get some education out of this?
I think there's a lot of interest in complicated, but maybe not too many ingredients, just because complicated as in it might take longer, but, you know, obviously there's a lot of shortages at grocery stores, and, you know, maybe you're working with chickpeas and you wanted kidney beans or whatever, so things like onion soup, which you really want to caramelize the onions for almost an hour to get it right. And if you have time to maybe make the stock, it's very few ingredients. I haven't just personally had sores out of onions yet, but, you know, it can still happen. I don't want to jinx it. So it's fairly basic ingredients. It's not a huge ingredient list, but you can make onion soup, which is like just so much better when you make it at home. Another thing that I've seen a few people making is I have this pulled pork recipe that's like five ingredients, where you put this salt, sugar, spice mix on it, and you do a slow roast of the pork shoulder, and you can make these crispy pulled pork sandwiches. And you might even have time to make the slider rolls and like a quick little slaw to go with it. It's like, it's not hard, and it's not a lot of ingredients. It's just, it takes a few hours.
That sounds fantastic. Let's get back to those caramelized onions, though, if we want them for a soup. Or caramelized onions are great, you know, on a sandwich or just about anything. Talk us through, how do we make those slow 1 hour caramelized onions?
I mean, you really just need a yellow onion. You want to cut it thin. I like to cook it in a mixture of olive oil and butter. Butter has a lower smoking point, so it burns more easily, but it has, of course, better flavor, I think, you know, in terms of, or, I mean, both can taste good, but you'll taste the butter more. Or if you have ghee available, you could use that, which is a sort of clarified butter, which you can use at a higher temperature, and it tastes amazing. Anyway, you want a couple tablespoons of that, a couple onions, although I know people who tend to just, if you're going to go through this hour process, it's like 45 minutes. But if you're going to go through it, you might as well just maybe make the whole bag of onions and then just have it, because you can freeze extra ones for future uses. So you basically just want to cook them slow and low. You're not trying to brown them. You're not trying to get them blistered at the edges. You're trying to cook it in this way where they slowly pick up this deep golden color. And you really want to stretch it out, and they end up being just booming with flavor, and they get very sweet and mellow. And as you said, they are the whole base of French onion soup. Like, that's it. Good bone broth and caramelized onions is basically all it is. Oh, and of course some cheese and bread. You could put it inside omelets. You could put it inside sandwiches. You can do so much with it once you make it. So it definitely seems worth making more. And since you might have the time to stand over the stove, it possibly might be a fun project.
We're talking to Deb Perlman, creator of the Smitten Kitchen blog. It's Food Friday. She's giving us some recipe ideas for maybe when we're cooking with a little more time on our hands. Maybe we might have gone to the restaurant, but the restaurant's closed right now. She has ideas for us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. By the way, you can find a lot of suggestions from Deb at smittenkitchen.com. She's got sections of sweet and these. Let's go to your calls now. Jan is with us in Elkhorn. Jan, hello.
Hello. Nice to
What do you
on.
Want to tell us about, Jan?
Well, a couple of things. There's some recipes that Julia Child's got that are a little more complicated than normal. Her French bread has three rises, and I tried making it starting on a Sunday afternoon and got it out of the oven at 1:30 in the morning and discovered that I had forgotten to put salt in it.
Oh, no.
But I ate it with butter, salt, and salted butter and extra salt sprinkled on, and I ate the whole loaf. So
okay.
Not right then, but over the course of the next little while.
And what's your next project, Jan?
The next one? Well, I was thinking, there's something, I'm thinking it's coq au vin. It's another French recipe. But something that's got chicken and sausage and beans and all that kind of stuff, and it cooks very slowly, and it sounds complicated, and I think that would be a good one to try. It's pretty hearty.
It's so wonderful.
Stuff.
I think you're in for a treat.
Jan, thank you so much for that. Let's go to the baking part of things. Deb, what do you have in mind when it comes to doing some baking projects?
I think there is no time like the present to master the art of a layer cake. But there's also, you know, there's slightly less complicated things. Like, I have this, and it's not particularly hard, but it is a project where I have this roll cake that you make with ice cream. Maybe you make your own ice cream. I mean, you've got the time. but it's a chocolate cake, and I think I have some mint chocolate chip ice cream in there because that was my favorite at that point. And you roll it up, and it's really fun and festive. And, you know, it's kind of nice because you're not going to be able to, you know, we're not going out, obviously, and maybe not have anybody else making cool desserts for you at a restaurant right now. So something else I really love in the archives is I have a couple icebox cakes. And I know they're traditionally made with these store-bought cookie wafers, but I have a really simple recipe where you make this very quick cookie dough and you roll it out between two pieces of parchment paper and you bake it right away. And you basically make cake-sized discs of it, of these cookies, and then you soften it with different flavors of whipped cream. And it's just the fanciest icebox cake you've ever had, but you haven't actually done a lot of work. It's just a little bit more involved. There's a chocolate peanut butter one that is extremely popular in my family.
That makes me think, Deb, you mentioned the parents at home with kids now. It sounds like parts of that recipe might be a fun one to do with kids. Do you have suggestions for people who are cooking at home to bring their kids into the team?
something really fun that I've actually done, and I always say this with like a grain of salt because I have kids and I cook for a living, and it is not like it always just comes together perfectly. Like they're not all kids are super into like cooking projects, and not all cooking has the time for kids to take their time with it, or like, you know, the margin of error. But something I think is really cool is I'm sure that, you know, with all the grocery store shortages, maybe you're not able to get your favorite sandwich bread or your favorite, like, you know, loaf bread or freeform bread. I have some really simple, but, you know, they still take a few hours just to rise. Sandwich bread recipes on the site that I love. There's a light wheat one, which is like a good, like, in between whole wheat and white bread, which I feel like is kind of where most people are at with sandwiches. There's an oat and whole wheat sandwich bread too. And we've actually been making focaccia a bit on the weekend. It's a no-knead recipe. It's very easy. And we split it and we sort of turn it into large format sandwiches, which you can like feed a crowd or, you know, feed us and then have leftovers for the next day. And they're not difficult, but they're really fun things to get the kids involved with because they like to see the bread grow. And because it's very few ingredients, it's kind of sort of hard to mess up.
We're talking to Deb Perlman, blogger at Smitten Kitchen. You can find her work at smittenkitchen.com. Her most recent cookbook is called Smitten Kitchen Everyday Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. We're talking about great recipes to make when we have a little more time on our hands. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have some favorite recipes that take a little more time, whether that's hands-on time in the kitchen or just planning ahead? Love to hear from you. Are you finding yourself spending more time in the kitchen cooking or baking this week? Do you find it a good form of stress relief? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also go to WPR.org/Food Friday, find links from Deb's work and also some of our other favorite Food Friday guests to give you some inspiration, some instruction too while you're at it. That's WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Deb Perlman of the popular cooking blog Smitten Kitchen. Her most recent cookbook is called Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. She's sharing some of her ideas for sweet and savory recipes to tackle if you're looking for a little bit of a kitchen project. We've got her suggestions linked at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you spent a little bit more time in the kitchen this week? Are you looking for projects for the days to come, maybe for this weekend? Are you trying baking or something new? Has this been a good way for you to relieve some stress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls. Chris is with us in Port Wing. Chris, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Chris?
Well, I'm working on a couple of recipes. We like to get a lot of things going at once and stock up. So I've got a recipe out of a book called Bean by Bean, wonderful book of bean recipes. And this is a red bean curry, essentially, in coconut milk. And it's not that hard to do, and it's great. So Bean by Bean is by Crescent Dragon Wagon, and I just wanted to mention to people who don't have a bookshelf full of cookbooks like we do over here at Sun Farm, go online. There's so many recipes that are available online, just hundreds of sites, and then you can probably even get a YouTube to show you how to bake bread, which I'm also doing, if you've never done it. It's very fun. It's a great thing to involve the young people with, and this Bean by Bean recipe is going to use onions and some nice spices, turmeric, cumin, coriander, a little bit of sugar, some salt, and then you put in some beans. Any kind of beans are going to work. The recipe calls for kidney beans, and you can use canned or you can cook them up from dried or whatever you got. And then you put in some chopped tomatoes, and they call for canned chopped tomatoes. And then the killer ingredient is the unsweetened coconut milk.
Ooh.
It makes it this creamy, rich, delightful sort of curry.
You can
add hot peppers to taste. I like a lot of spice. Some people don't, but that kind of is on your own.
That sounds fantastic, Chris. Thank you so much. That sounds... Oh, and we've got a second on this. Our executive producer, Judith Sears-Poisson, says she makes that exact recipe from that exact book. You are not alone, Chris. That's fantastic. Deb, that sounds pretty good to me.
I would definitely make that. And hey, you've got time to soak your own beans. I mean, why not? They'll taste better. You'll have a better texture. Why not?
Hey, and on your list, thanks for that call, Chris. On your list, Deb, you had a pizza beans. You've got that on your website where you're making beans to make a pizza?
Yeah. So that's a little bit of marketing. So because it's basically the, it's actually perfect, though, for if you want to soak your own beans. Because my favorite kind of beans to make it with are the Royal Corona beans, which are these large white beans from Rancho Gordo. I understand that not everybody has Rancho Gordo beans. Any kind of large white bean, they might be sold as gigante beans. Sometimes a lupini bean might work, depending on what kind of markets you have near you. But they usually come dried because they're not like a, they're not as popular as like chickpeas. And so you would want to soak them and cook them yourself. But after that, you make this amazing, I think it's amazing. So you saute them with a lot of vegetables and then some canned tomatoes, and you add white beans. Basically, it's like a baked ziti, but you're using these giant white beans instead of pasta. And then at the very end, you add a lot of cheese on top, and you broil it until it's crispy and melty. And we often serve it with garlic bread, because why not? And I, it was called a white gigante bean bake with, you know, kale and vegetables. I don't remember what it was, but my kids were like, ew! And I was like, no, it's like tomato sauce and cheese, and you're going to have bread. It's like pizza. It's like pizza beans. And like somehow that did the trick. So it is a little bit of marketing. They are given a pizza treatment. There's no pepperoni or anything. So you're free. You should definitely do that if you want. There's no meat in the dish, but you could definitely add some ground meat or pancetta or bacon if you wanted. But it's just a really nice, hearty vegetarian meal. And if you can soak your own beans and cook them, it's really nice. It makes a wonderful textured dish.
I want to make sure I understand this, Deb. If I call a bean dish a pizza dish, I can get kids to eat it?
I mean, I'm not saying it'll work for all kids everywhere, but somehow it did the trick. Yes. I mean, I don't know why I'm surprised by this, that like kids would be more into pizza than like, you know, some bean variety they hadn't heard of cooked with kale. But it really goes over well, and it's delicious, and it's fun. I mean, because you really are eating something that's like quite wholesome, usually in a way that you don't get it as often. And I love trying to find ways to make beans full meals. I mean, we all know about chili, but like, do you know about ziti beans?
Ziti beans? I do not know
That's basically what the idea of it, turning them into
ziti. Oh, that's this pizza.
I've done it with some other things too. Forgive me, I don't have this on the site, but I've also done it where I have like, I've used chickpeas instead of pasta and sort of an eggplant. I'm thinking of pasta alla norma. It's like a spicy tomato sauce with chunks of eggplant in it. And I've also done that. I'm using chickpeas instead of pasta, and it bakes up really nicely in a dish.
Chris, thanks for your call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. Deb Perlman is with us from the Smitten Kitchen blog, author of cookbooks as well. We got an email from Grant. Grant says baking sourdough typically takes 36 to 48 hours from start to finish. Slow bread making is time very well spent. Grant, thank you so much for that. Yeah, this could be a good time to maybe start up our own sourdough collection or make other kinds of bread. And it's a timely project, but it does pay off, Deb.
I would love to learn to get into sourdough in this time off from things.
Right.
Although for me, my day-to-day may not look terribly different than people who have offices and stuff.
Definitely.
But yeah, I think it's a great time to get into sourdough. Also, until you kind of get it down, you really need to watch it because you don't really know exactly, you know, whether it's going to be an 8-hour thing or a 10-hour thing. And so being able to be at home, it's like a great time to learn it.
Now, you mentioned if we've stocked up on dried pasta or just had a bunch in our larder, Jan and Appleton passed along a standby veggie mac and cheese, just a can of chili beans, a can of diced tomatoes, as much macaroni as you want, some red onions and cheese on top. Now, that's a pretty quick and easy one. Do you have thoughts, Deb, on, okay, we're staring at boxes or bags of pasta, fun ways to use those?
Absolutely. I actually have a macaroni and cheese recipe way back in the archives that I actually dusted off this past summer just because we were having people over and it seemed like the right time. You actually don't boil the pasta at all. You mix it with a couple cups of milk and a not insubstantial amount of cheddar cheese, and you bake the whole thing together, and the milk cooks the pasta, and you end up with this cheesy, crispy, like completely decadent baked pasta dish. Of course, it's not that we don't have time to bake our own, cook our own pasta now, but it's just sort of a neat trick that you can do. It's called, I want to say it's called crispy baked macaroni and cheese, easiest baked macaroni and cheese on the site. What else? I mean, this is a really good time to make a couple of lasagnas. You'll be happy to have them. They keep really well. They freeze well. And I also think it's really nice to try to make your own bolognese sauce or another like more long cooking sauce that you would put on pasta, like a ragu or something with braised meat.
Sounds fantastic. Deb, as we wrap up, what is your next cooking project?
I have some dough going right now. It's Friday. Got to make the kids happy. That, yes, involves pizza. So I'm making a grandma-style pizza. Kind of the type that's baked in a pan that's a little bit thicker. I've made a few over the last couple of years, and I haven't really found my favorite recipe yet, but I think this might be it. We weren't able to get the mozzarella we usually use, but we were able to get those, like, little balls of mozzarella, so I'm curious to see how those will bake up. I expect it to be good. I'm going to make a batch of my favorite Caesar salad dressing because it keeps really well in a jar. I might as well make a lot of it so we can keep eating salad and not just survive on pasta and beans. So I'll make that and I'll make a Caesar salad too. And then it is Friday. It's been a week. We might mix up some Manhattans later after the kids go to bed.
That Wild sounds Friday like night the best recipe here. Of all. I love it. Deb, thank you as always for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Deb Perlman, creator of the Smitten Kitchen blog. Her most recent cookbook is called Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumphant and Unfussy New Favorites. You can find links to browse her suggestions for sweet and savory project recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. While you're there, we've got some other resources and links as well. To help in the time of social distancing, Christopher Kimball of Milk Street Radio is offering a free online cooking school now through April 30th. We've got an interview with him on Central Time on our website as well. America's Test Kitchen has put together some resources. We've got links there at WPR.org/Food Friday. And Samin Nusrat has some home cooking recipes on a new podcast. So links to all of that and lots of recipes for your own home cooking. Find them all at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up, we'll talk to a state lawmaker who wants exemptions for religious organizations to limits on gatherings. Stick around. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, home rental sites like Airbnb have gotten pretty popular in recent years, but it hasn't always been easy for state and local governments to regulate them and collect taxes. We'll talk about a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum that takes a closer look at how that issue plays out across the state. First, Governor Tony Evers announced this week that there would be a ban on nearly all gatherings of more than 10 people as the state attempts to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus. There are currently more than 200 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the state. There are some exemptions to the gathering restrictions, including some government operations, relief facilities, hospitals, grocery stores, and others. But among the groups faced with a gathering restriction are religious institutions, things like churches, mosques, and synagogues. Our next guest recently wrote a letter to Governor Evers asking him to make an allowance for places of worship to get exemptions from those restrictions. State Senator David Craig is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 28th Senate District, which includes Big Bend. Senator Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, in your letter to Governor Evers, what are you looking for when it comes to possible exemptions for places of worship?
Yeah, and so what I asked the governor to do was simply to consider options to provide what we call a narrowly tailored accommodation that I think is constitutionally required to be given to a place of worship to help facilitate worship practices while providing social distancing. And if that wasn't, if such an accommodation under the governor's consideration wasn't possible, then specific information as to why that's the case. And so, we have a number of exemptions that were in the executive order. And part of that is, I think just logically, you have churches that are provide a very important function to individuals. Some faiths, that's the most important facet of their life is their faith, the ability to exercise their faith. And a one-size-fits-all order that functionally makes it impossible to exercise that belief for things like, congregational worship, sacramental worship, is a serious serious thing. And I think that the government, when it upsets a fundamental right like that, needs to go through very serious considerations. And one of those considerations, and I think is constitutionally required, is that the government make a narrowly tailored implementation of such a restriction. And so you might have a church that's 200 square feet. You might have a church that's 50,000 square feet. But no matter what, that regulation limits both of those churches the same way. That is not what I would consider to be a narrowly tailored accommodation. And so you have many, many large churches where, if you have 9 individuals that are meeting, they can do so in a socially responsible or via social distancing way. Should we not be considering allowing a worship organization to have more people in such a large facility? And I think the science, from what I can tell, says that because we have all these different exemptions that are supposedly based on the science. That where we've exempted or activities inside schools that aren't academic, that is particularly exempted. We have other exemptions for retail establishments. These are important functions where I think exemptions are warranted, but I don't think that the state should give short shrift to places of worship and the importance that those hold for individuals that go to worship there. And it may be as minimal as one time a week. It may be as minimal as one time every 2 weeks because of the extraordinary circumstances. But the state's position, as it's stated right now, is a one-size-fits-all, regardless of the number of square feet. And I think that that's something that the state needs to take a closer look at.
Senator Craig, you mentioned the Constitution. Can you talk more about your constitutional concerns in particular?
Yeah, I mean, we have very strong, and on top of the First Amendment, federally, we have a very strong religious protections in our state constitution. And I'll just read you the appropriate part of the Constitution. It's Article 1, Section 18, that says that the right of every person to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their conscience shall never be infringed, nor shall any control or interference with the rights of conscience be permitted. And so that's very, very strict language. The state Supreme Court has said that basically what strict scrutiny should apply to that. And when strict scrutiny is applied, that means that if the government has a compelling state interest to act, which I think it does in this situation, given the severity of the circumstances, it has to do so in the least restrictive way possible. And a blanket order, as I stated, and for the reasons I stated, I do not believe that that blanket order provides that constitutional standard, the least restrictive means possible.
We're talking to State Senator David Craig, Republican representing Wisconsin's 28th Senate District, which includes Big Bend. We're talking about restrictions on gatherings in Wisconsin. He wants the governor to go back and take another look at religious organizations, try to figure out tailored exemptions in some cases. We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page, Senator Craig. Sherry writes, I understand how important worship is to many people, especially this time of year, and even in many ways to the older population who may be less likely to have the technology or knowledge to access online streaming options. But, Sherry writes, those are also the most vulnerable to this illness, and to knowingly encourage them to gather would be reckless at best, if not intentionally harmful. Better to create phone trees of congregation members to check in with those who are home alone and provide them with community in that way. What do you think of Sherry's concerns, Senator Craig?
Yeah, I mean, she raises, I think, legitimate concerns. A number of the individuals that might be more susceptible also have strong faith that they would consciously choose to exercise. These are individuals who, if they are of an older age, maybe they take, you know, their religious faith even more seriously to help them, you know, to cope with some of the issues of old age. And again, you have religions, and not only Christianity, but other religions that practice sacramentally, where there's a physical interaction. So, you know, it's very easy for individuals, I think, to say, hey, this can all be done virtually. And I think to a great extent, individuals are going to be able to do that. However, there are instances where in sacramental religions, there is a physical component. There is a congregational component. And the state needs to take that seriously. These, again, are fundamental rights. This isn't something that, you know, that's kind of a privilege that's granted. This is a fundamental right recognized throughout our nation's history and prior to that. And the state, I think, needs to make accommodations, especially when there is not a reason that's been identified to have why you wouldn't have a narrower accommodation made.
Some people might point, Senator Craig, to South Korea, where a lot of the cases there had been transmitted through one Christian organization, viewed widely as eccentric there, I think, but they had spread amongst themselves and then in the outside community, COVID-19. Is that a concern, even if, as we're respecting the rights of people to come to this congregation, that might be spreading the illness to the wider community?
Yeah, and I'm not saying that an organization shouldn't practice their religion in a socially and health responsible way. All I'm saying is I have seen no evidence whatsoever that the administration, when producing the executive order, considered things like not only social distancing, but if a church were to engage in social distancing and engage in deep cleaning practices, things of that nature, where an individual might be much, you know, safer going to church and not getting exposed because of practices that have been explored and accepted to keep people healthy in those places. Whereas you can go anywhere under the order for retail to get your groceries or whatever. It doesn't matter how many places you go to, and you might not have as protective practices in place. And so all I'm saying is I want there to be the freedom, and I'm encouraged, frankly, that the governor did not put in place and mentioned this afternoon that he doesn't have plans to put in place a shelter in place order, like it sounds like Illinois is headed toward. But what I am saying is we have these situations. The government should have explored and produced to the public a rationale as to why it didn't explore those options, where allowing 20 people, 25 people, 50 people in a larger space where they're able to use social distancing, where they're able to do so in a way where they're, you know, sanitizing and all the things that we're all doing right now. Why should that gathering not be able to take place? And I'm not saying, hey, let's open it back up to, you know, previous practice, because obviously not every congregation, you know, could do that. Not every congregation could accommodate via social distancing what you know, society is deeming to be, you know, the appropriate health etiquette. But I think the government, again, needs to demonstrate that it has done the deliberation, that it is producing information, giving it to the public, giving it to individuals of faith to let them know these are the considerations that were made, and this is why we ended at, you know, less than 10 people. And again, give us the reason why the government is treating a 1,000-square-foot congregation the same as a 50,000-square-foot congregation.
Senator Craig, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
State Senator David Craig is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 28th Senate District, which includes Big Bend. He joined us today to talk about his call for churches and other places of worship to potentially get exemptions from the state's ban on gatherings of more than 10 people amid the coronavirus outbreak. He wrote a letter to the governor asking him to review that policy. Just one update, we see that Illinois has now officially apparently put a shelter-in-place order in place. Coming up, we'll find out how home rental sites like VRBO are affecting tax revenue for the state and local governments across Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, measures being taken to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus are already challenging people and businesses around Wisconsin. We'll talk to reporters around the state about how people are supporting each other, from community tip jars to free meals for students. Now, home rental sites like Airbnb and VRBO have become more and more popular in recent years. And for states and local governments across the country, that's meant some good news and some bad news. On the one hand, there's growing tax revenue to be found in home rentals. On the other hand, there have been big challenges trying to collect that revenue in the first place. Our next guest recently took a closer look at how this is playing out across Wisconsin. Jason Stein is the research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's with us to talk about their latest report. It's called Rise in Home Rentals Creates a Taxing Dilemma. Jason, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob. Pleasure.
Before we get into the report, Jason, we'll put an asterisk on it. Obviously, travel is changing a lot. It's going to be much more limited. We'll have to be watching in the months to come to see how it affects some of the things you looked at, right?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, it's amazing to think how much the world has changed in just the 10 days or something like that since this research brief came out. But, you know, in the hopes that an expectation that we will eventually return to some kind of normalcy, we can talk about it.
And these, so we originally these VRBOs and things like that, they were in your big tourist cities, I think, and they spread more and more. How big a deal have they gotten to be in Wisconsin in recent years?
Oh, I mean, they're more and more significant all the time. We requested data from the Wisconsin Department of Revenue and found that sales tax collections from online marketplaces such as Airbnb for home lodging rose almost 47% in 2019 as both the market grew and state and local collection efforts ramped up. And we can sort of talk about some of the ways that that happened.
Yeah, this was a moving target. It seemed like at one point it was just, yeah, if you happen to think of it, property owners sent in some taxes. How has that evolved over the years?
Right. So this was at one time something that was supposed to be remitted by individuals or by the owners of the home or short-term lodging place. But over time, we've had changes. I mean, that started with a 2018 U.S. Supreme Court ruling. It was called South Dakota v. Wayfair, that prompted the state of Wisconsin to require out-of-state retailers to start collecting Wisconsin sales taxes. And, you know, sales taxes do apply to lodging sales, but then it was, you know, left somewhat unclear if local room taxes would also need to be collected and remitted. And that, you know, remained in limbo for some time. But then we, you know, recently got clarity on that. And now that is required for sites like Airbnb and others. And so that's one of the reasons why, you know, the expectation was for, you know, going into 2020 to see substantial increases in those collections. Now, obviously, with the current crisis that we're in, there's been a big hit to lodging sales of all types. So some of those things have been shifted, those expectations. But certainly in more of a long-term framework, you're going to see these collections from online marketplaces rise.
And Jason, you mentioned that there are state and some local taxes that apply. Can you talk about some of the different room tax type of arrangements that we have in different communities in Wisconsin?
Sure. So there's a state sales tax of 5%. There's county sales taxes in 68 of the 72 Wisconsin counties that are 0.5%. Then certain communities like Sister Bay, Eagle River, the Dells impose a local municipal sales tax that is up to 1.25%. And then there are a variety of room taxes that are imposed around the state and generally limited to up to 8%. So, you know, depending on the community where you're at, there could be several different types of taxes that would be applied to the lodging sale.
And as I understand from your report, Jason, there are limits in some cases at the state and local levels on what this tax money can then be used for. What kind of limitations are there?
Right. So, you know, one thing that's interesting is some people might think, oh, well, you know, if the state's trying to collect these sales taxes, it's just to spend more. You know, in fact, what came out of the Wayfair decision is there's a requirement in state law that the increase in sales taxes from online sales has got to be used to decrease income taxes. So first off, that's what happens with that. Now county sales taxes would still, those could still be boosted. At the local level, when you talk about room taxes, most of those are used for tourism promotion, doing things that would promote and draw overnight stays in the communities that impose those room taxes. There is some portion of it, and it does vary somewhat by locality, but there is a portion of the room taxes that can be used for discretionary needs for the spending that the local community identifies.
We're talking to Jason Stein, Research Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, about things like HomeAway, Airbnb, VRBO, these places where people rent homes or apartment units, and how they get taxed and regulated at the state and local levels. And Jason, behind all this is kind of a fundamental question that comes up a lot when we think of the so-called sharing economy with something like these rentals. Are they hotels subject to state and local hotel regulations? Are they different? This all raises big questions in how state government works, right?
Yes, I think so. And that was one reason why we looked at this. In the greater scheme of things, the taxes that are paid on these home rentals are not the largest issue in state or local government. But I think it's emblematic of broader changes that you see in our economy and the need for government over time to keep up. And there's a lot of competing priorities in those cases. You know, on the one hand, the local governments want to seek to collect taxes. They want to maintain consistency between, you know, some traditional provider, whether it's a hotel or a taxi cab business, and an upstart business that, whether that's someone renting out their home on Airbnb, or that whether that's someone logging into the Uber app and serving as a driver and doing that sort of thing for ride hailing apps. So again, you know, there's this balance that governments need to try to strike between having adequate regulation and adequate collecting of taxes, and also, you know, not coming down too strongly on a market that, you know, again, may be, you know, people that are just trying to, you know, rent their home for a few times each year and may only be willing to bear a certain amount of regulation.
Do we know if there's further state legislation on things like these home rentals in the works now or anticipated in the near future?
There is. On February 20th, the Assembly passed legislation that would require marketplaces to remit, these are the online lodging marketplaces, to remit room taxes to municipalities on a quarterly basis and report on certain things as part of that process. I believe that where that now stands is in the Senate, awaiting action there. So there is, you know, again, further legislation. And like a lot of things in our state right now, it's somewhat in limbo.
Right. And Jason, briefly, have we had kind of a coordinated response to the rise of these new businesses, or are we kind of just ad hoc making it up as we go?
I mean, again, I think in the case of for lodging marketplaces, there really has been a fairly comprehensive framework that's been put into place. And I think one of the reasons why we wanted to write about it is because I think that's not necessarily the case when you think about some other types of internet commerce and internet providers that have arisen in recent years. And so I think, you know, there may be lessons that can be drawn from the case of lodging marketplaces and applied to, you know, other aspects of the economy and the sharing economy in particular as we go forward.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
We've been talking to Jason Stein, Research Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He was with us today to talk about their latest report on how online home rental sites are impacting tax revenue here in Wisconsin. You can find that report linked on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. While you're there, leave us a comment if you rent things out. If you rent out your own property, love to know how that works for you. That's at wpr.org/centraltime. Yesterday on the show, I mentioned that Monday is National Puppy Day, and I shared some of the top puppy names of the last year. And then just on the spur of the moment, I invited you to send in your puppy pictures, and some of you did. And then it hit me, if we get enough of those photos of puppies from you, we can build it into an online article or slideshow or something featuring the puppies of Central Time listeners and their friends and people who just happen to have stumbled across the show at the right moment. So here's how you can help. Send us a picture of your puppy, include the puppy's name, please, and write a note that says we can use the picture on social media. Here's how to send it to us. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's our email, ideas@wpr.org, or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. I guess you could call in and give us a description of your puppy, and then our producer, Dean Canetter, can do an artist's rendering that we could post online. I assume he's a pretty good artist, but I don't know that. So the safer bet, email that picture of your puppy to ideas@wpr.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. If we get enough pictures, we can make this a thing by National Puppy Day or shortly thereafter, and I'll let you know when to check it out. Trying to bring you puppies when you need them the most, this is Central Time.